about him growing up. It was actually sort of semi-autobiographical.
Mm.
And it is about these Grinsteads and a suicide that happened with someone who was in the Church of Scientology.
Right.
So, wrong, but it's,
have you read American Gods?
Yes.
Are you looking forward to the new show?
I am.
Yeah. I haven't read American Gods, but I'm looking forward to the new. Brian Fuller makes good TV shows.
Yeah.
It's a shame he's not. Because it's a shame he's not really doing Discovery anymore, but American Gods should be really, really good.
Oh, yeah.
It'll get cancelled after two seasons, of course.
No, with his...
Brian Fuller. Brian Fuller's so cerebral that the networks go, this is great, but I don't know what's going on, and neither do our advertisers.
He's Hannibal.
Yeah, which was glorious, even if somewhat impenetrable.
Oh, yeah, it was wallpaper TV, though, wasn't it? Really?
Yes, yeah, no, that's a lovely way of looking at it, actually. Yeah.
Wallpaper TV.
Yeah.
What have you about the soundtracks to Hannibal? Because I actually gave
that's
really interesting.
Yeah, if you're us.
Yeah.
If you're us. I don't know whether or not it's at your.
It's not very.
It's a bit avant-garde.
It is avant-garde. But the bloke who did that was.
Didn't take my meaning.
was in the band Air.
Right, yeah.
You know, and.
Avant-garde.
Sexy boy.
Mm. Yeah, I'm familiar with the work of Air.
Yeah. Being a sexy boy.
And I'm also familiar with being a sexy boy. We should begin.
That's a good Easter egg to go there.
And
who said logic is the cement of our civilization with which we ascend from EKS using reason as our guide?
T. Plana Hoth, matron of Vulcan philosophy.
Correct. What is the molecular formula of humanium sulfide crystals? White queen to section 5, grid 6, queen takes knight, rook takes queen, white pawn to section 5, grid 7, pawn takes rook. Checkmate. What significant contribution to bioengineering was made in Lucarian outposts on Clint?
The universal atmospheric element compensator.
Evaluate and conclude. A starship sensor is indicated as being pursued. Go closely that it occupies the same space as its pursuer.
Correct.
Identify object and its cultural significance.
Klingon mummification glyph.
What were the principal historical events on the planet Earth in the year 1987?
Correct.
What was Kira Kim Fah's first law of metaphysics?
Nothing unreal exists.
Correct.
Adjust the sine wave of this magnetic envelope so that anti-neutrons can pass through it, but anti-gravitons cannot.
Correct.
What is the electronic configuration of gadolinium?
Correct.
How do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel?
I do not understand the question.
Hello, and thank you once again for downloading another edition of Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am Terry DeFellin, and I am joined, as always, by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And by Derek Mantle.
Hello.
How are we doing, guys? Yes?
Good.
Yes,
good.
Excellent. Yeah.
It's great to be back.
It's good to be back.
It doesn't seem like 5 minutes ago since we last sat around this table.
Talking about Star Trek, it doesn't. Possibly because it was 5 minutes ago. Well, not wanting to shine light on magic listeners, but yes, we record episodes back to back. That's why improvements happen on 2 week or fortnightly increments. We're really looking forward to talking about Star Trek for the Voyage Home on this episode of Whom Pods Destroy, because I think it is among our very favourite movies. Mm. And I'm going to ask you, Graham.
Yes.
Star Trek 2 or Star Trek 4 or another? What's your top two? Is it?
It's easier top two. I'd like to say. I'm turned around on motion picture these days.
Motion picture is much better film than people say.
It is much better. Yeah. But is it as good as those two? Four for me, actually. I think Star Trek Two always seems to be the one that real Star Trek fans go for ahead of Star Trek Four, because Star Trek Four has got such popular appeal.
Yeah,
but it's got such popular appeal because it's such a really, really good film.
It's a brilliantly made film.
Yeah, Star Trek Two. I mean, I love it, warts and all, because it's covered in warts.
It certainly is. Yeah, it's a ridiculously cheap movie.
Yeah, it is.
And at times it really shows how cheap it is.
It is.
Nevertheless, it's a triumph.
It is a triumph because it's so cheap. It's made for like buttons, and they bring out something that's really, and they go, and it's carried forward by performance and story, and that shows that you can.
Wrath of Khal Drogo is a visceral film. Whereas Voyage Home is not. Voyage Home is a much more even emotionally. You don't necessarily get the ups and downs.
There
you
is
get.
That. I mean, I think people sort of take it. I think there's more to this film than just a sort of light-hearted. Oh, it's the one with the whales, isn't
yeah.
it? And there's lots of, because there is lots of light-hearted stuff in there.
Yeah,
but it
those
is
San Francisco
well.
Scenes are yeah. There are comedy. They
yeah,
are, there's genuine comedy in that.
Yeah, but there's also peril in there as well at
yes.
the beginning.
Yeah,
the beginning
yeah.
is full of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So actually, this is actually some serious problem coming up.
And the ending is very uplifting as well.
Yeah.
What about you, Dale? Wrath of Khan or Voyage Home or another? Or do you have a? Do you have a? Would you, would
it
you
put, is actually Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still would go. I would go for that over four. You know, the Voyage Home is good. You know, it's good. But funny enough, I haven't seen it as many times as all that.
Have you not? I've you seen know. Voyage Home. I would say I've seen Wrath of Khan most, and then I think it's probably Voyage Home is a close second.
Yeah, I've probably only seen Voyage Home three times.
Wow.
So you okay. know, and I was trying to convince my daughter to watch it with me. She was watching a little bit of it, but you know, she would probably get into it because she doesn't like all the Star Trek stuff, you know, science fiction stuff. But I think she would enjoy that.
Yeah,
you know. So
let's begin with a brief synopsis for those that haven't seen it. Turn off if you haven't seen this film, because you go and watch. Because seriously, it's a lovely film. It's the sequel to Star Trek III: The Search for Spock. It's the final part of what turns out to be a trilogy, although I don't think that they intended it to be a trilogy from the beginning. Kirk and the crew are about to go home to face trial for having stolen the Enterprise in order to bring Spock back to life. Unfortunately, in the meantime, the Earth is under attack from a giant cigar, which is trying to speak to humpback whales who are dead. So Kirk and the crew resolve to go back to San Francisco in the 1980s and transport some humpback whales back. Hijinks ensue, I guess.
I have to take them to task with the cigar. I thought it was one of those long black piece of licorice that you get in licorice all sorts.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know,
no, yeah.
And I thought it was probably
right.
the worst.
Oh my God, he's right. All these years I've been thinking cigar. But no, it's not. It's a licorice all sorts.
It is, you know. And even the bit that comes out of it, the little ball, actually looks a bit like it could be in the licorice all sorts as well.
It could be.
All
and
it's
these
probably
years
the worst.
Labouring on it.
Bit of special effects ever. Really.
Well, I don't think it's bad special effects. I just think it's an interesting design.
It's a bad design.
You don't like it?
No.
What do you think of it, Graham?
I think, you know, it looks alien and it looks like non-humanoid.
Which is the idea.
Yeah,
it looks
fine to me. Mm. The one thing I remember most about it is the sound of it. The sound. The actual. But also when it starts making the communications, those noises. And I remember when we went to see all the first five films in one day.
Oh, mate.
Yeah, when was that? 1990.
Yeah,
it was for the early release of Star Trek V, wasn't it? Bloody hell!
Oh my God, such a come down that was.
But Star Trek IV came on, and they must have ramped up the volume in there because I was hearing that communications for days afterwards.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was ringing in my ears still.
Was it Leicester Square?
Yeah, this was at Leicester Square, and like they had the sound, it was full-on sound.
Speaking of Leicester Square, I mean, let's just go back and tell the story of when we saw this together, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
Because that's how long we've known each other.
Yeah.
We went when it came out in the cinema. It came out in the UK in March 87.
Yeah.
But it was launched in the US for Thanksgiving 86.
Yeah.
And we had to wait months.
Well, I know you couldn't wait. I mean,
I couldn't wait. I read the comic adaptation.
You read the that was the DC adaptation.
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
it?
Yeah. I wasn't disappointed.
No, you bought it and you said you weren't going to read it.
And I did. Of course I did. I just couldn't resist it. And so I knew what was happening.
Yeah.
And I knew everything when I went in there. But it was fine. That didn't bother me at all. I was really happy and I loved the film. We went with a couple of mates to go and see it at the Odeon Leicester or the Empire Leicester Square.
It was the Empire,
where were you sat?
I was sat on row N, seat 4.
Right, so just behind.
Just behind M5.
Just behind row M, seat 5.
Yeah.
And so what did you say?
I said, M5, Tsunami.
This is history. We're completely geeked out over a seat number.
Empire, you know me.
And to his credit, the chap in front of us got the joke.
He did. And, he was sat in M7.
M7, but he understood what was going on here.
Yeah. And someone sat down in M5 and just didn't know.
Nope. I mean, if I had gone to see a Star Trek film and I sat in CM5, I'm 48 and I would still go,
"Empire, you know me,"
or possibly under my breath. But
It was actually interesting when I went to Oxford to watch the Star Wars film, Episode 7, and I was sat in seat BB9.
Oh.
So I thought if I had that on my ticket, that would have been
that's definitely one for the memory box.
Yeah,
isn't it?
You remind me. I was really pissed off with. I went to see. Sally got me tickets to see John Barry years ago at the Royal Palladium, and I thought, yeah, this is brilliant. I, you know, no one else, you know, that I knew at work had it. Someone else at work had got his ticket 007. for the box, his girlfriend got it for him.
No way.
And I thought,
But yes, that was the story, and it was a one that's 30 years ago.
I know, 30 years ago.
30 years ago, next month, that was.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that film was made to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Star Trek. So, after that, which seems positively young by today's standard, by now.
Well, you did mention that was because it was 20 years from the original Star Trek to that.
Yeah, and it's been longer.
And
since
it's another 30 bloody years? Oh,
yeah.
God.
And so when it was released, it was during the sort of production of, the start of production of the Next Generation, isn't it?
Yes, that was announced as well. Yeah. So we knew there was more Trek coming.
Yeah.
And we had, I think by that point, we had a good idea about what kind of Trek it was going to be. We knew it was going to be set later in the line. It wasn't going to involve original series characters or anything like that. We were all sort of, but I think we were probably looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. But much like today with Discovery, with misgivings and concerns. But I'm sure that they obviously ironed themselves out. So returning to the film itself, directed by Leonard Nimoy, again, he directed the third film, second in the trilogy. This film's got a very different beat to it, hasn't it? I mean, it starts off quite grim. Because there's disaster occurring and it looks like they're going back to face justice and things are going to go bad. There's a great sequence with the Klingon ambassador, John Shook, who we mentioned in earlier episodes. He's in this one. And his delivery is right out of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely glorious. And we get to see the Federation, the president of the Federation of Planets, and it's great for yourself because you're a big Star Trek fan. It's like you're still only having watched the 79 episodes of Star Trek, the previous three movies.
Mm.
So yes, there's still lots of like the Federation and all of that, which is not something that you see. So it's all like, well, wow, look, you know, that's the Federation, all these other aliens, and look, it's the Federation, and look, it's Starfleet Academy, and wow, isn't that, it's all lovely world-building stuff.
Well, I mean, it's quite an interesting opening scene where it opens up on the, which I think we had seen before. We'd seen going back to sort of map paintings. That it opens up in San Francisco Bay where you see the shuttles landing and people walking across.
I think that might have come from motion picture.
What I thought. Thinking about that.
Yeah.
You know,
they did do that even up as far as then. Yeah. They still drew just occasion, not to the point of Wrath of Khan, which we're doing.
Being a real nerd, I was actually going to say that the sort of security guards who are actually in the chamber and stuff like that are still wearing the same security guard uniform that they use in the motion picture.
That's a great spot, and that's not even remotely nerdy.
It's an interesting. I mean. When I sat down to watch it again recently, what I did find, though, you're saying that the actual plot is actually quite grim. I'm bringing this quite early, though. I want to bring in the actual music, because the music starts off at the beginning of when you sit down to watch this. It is very uplifting, very 80s and very American as well.
An interesting point on that music, because this film was released for the Thanksgiving weekend, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
And so it is basically their Christmas movie.
Yeah.
So there is, you can get little... If this was suddenly like the music for a Christmas film, you would not be surprised.
Yeah.
It's got that sort of elements in there.
Leonard Rosenman, the composer, and was brought in a friend of Leonard Nimoy. James Horner would have done it. Wanted to do it, but couldn't do it. But what's interesting is that the previous two soundtracks that James Horner did were much more dramatic in tone. Mm. And I would imagine that probably his brief would have been to have... And I'm sure that Rosenman didn't impose this score on the film. I'm sure he was briefed to give this... This is a largely happy movie. And there's going to be some comedic moments in it, and we want the score to reflect this. Mm. And Rosenman, a veteran composer, and a top pro, would have done that. I'm sure that Horner would have done the same. I wanted to just point out, do you guys remember a film called Cocoon?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Actually,
Horner had done this movie, the score would have been very much like his score to Cocoon.
Okay, yeah, because that's what the whole thing felt like. It felt very sort of, quite light.
Yes.
You know, because of the music.
Yeah,
coming through there, and as you said, it's like the Christmas movie, and very 80s and American.
Yeah,
unfortunately, something that was stuck in my head was this was American TV, and I was actually thinking The Love Boat, which for some reason because of the colours and the sort of like being out in the sea.
Yes.
Lots of blues and whites. And
I was thinking more along the lines of, is it John Hughes who made those movies in the 1980s?
Yes.
Ferris Bueller and the Planes, Trains, Automobiles.
Yeah.
There were times when this felt like I was watching a John Hughes movie in some sections. And that's a lovely thing, because those movies are lovely.
It is very interesting, because if you look at other films from about this time, it covers a lot of the same sort of ground. This film is part time travel story, part fish out of water
thing.
And they are so... massive 1986 themes.
Yes.
You've got to think, this is, what, a year after Back to the Future. Same year as Peggy Sue Got Married.
Mm.
And it comes out 2 months in the States after Crocodile Dundee.
Oh, Lord, yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
See, if you compare Crocodile Dundee in New York and the Trek crew in San Francisco, you get lots of very, very similar scenes, lots of similar gags are coming up over and over again.
Yeah,
And this whole fish out of water thing.
Yeah.
But also as well with the time travel aspect of what you get with like Back to the Future and other films as well.
See, I wonder to what extent they cashed in or took advantage of that.
Certainly in the public's sort of appetite for it.
Yeah,
because obviously there were these are really really successful films. These are films that grossed multiple times what they cost to make.
Yeah, and the film. I mean, the Voyage Home is. I mean, it's not a cheap film by any means.
No,
but it is a film. It's a mid-range budget.
Yeah,
movie, but obviously by this point, any of the budgetary constraints that they had before are pretty much lifted, because they know they're going to make a ton of money out of this. So everything is done and looks really, really nice. Yeah. So all the locations are just what they want.
They are
to
paying
be.
For the actors as well, though, this time. Kirk and Nimoy are really...
Yeah, and rightly so, because, this movie, they knew it was going to make them squillions of dollars, and so it's only right that they have a...
And also,
given the success of the previous two films.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, it's really interesting, because Leonard Nimoy is directing this.
Yeah.
And the thing is, he obviously showed his chops with the previous film.
Mm.
But also, this was after... his films that he did,
Three Men and a Baby,
which again it seems that.
That was also a phenomenal hit at the time, wasn't it?
Big,
so
yeah, it made lots of money for that.
So he's looking at this because I mean, apparently the story is that he was given a certain degree of free rein on Search for Spock, but we're still, because it was his debut, because it was a big movie, and they knew it was going to be a big movie, that they were quite, the studio and the producers and that were over, there was a lot of oversight. Harve Bennett was looking over his shoulder. But with this movie, they trusted him to just go and make this film how he wanted to, within reason, how he wanted to make it. And he has produced a film for the mid-80s, and a classic example that is up there with all of those great sort of like light comedy slash drama movies of that era. And it sits, I think it sits really well in there with them. Can we talk a little bit about Catherine Hicks, who's the main guest star role in this, Gillian Taylor, and then we can talk a little bit about the whales. So some of my one of my favourite scenes in this movie is when she gives Kirk and Spock a lift back.
Yeah, that's a funny one.
I mean, there, the three of them are just amazing, and he's made for completely for laughs, obviously.
Well, that whole scene starts really with them at the Cetacean Institute, isn't it? And the scene where Spock is actually in the tank.
Yes.
And Kirk's face, obviously. It is brilliant. Yeah. It is utterly brilliant. And this is another side of Nimoy knowing the actor, isn't it? Really getting the most out of it as well. And so, and then the scene coming straight afterwards. Yes. And then her meeting them up afterwards and giving them a lift.
And then giving them a lift, and then she ends up getting dragged into that. And I mean, it's nice to have a guest star in, and it's nice to have her doing something. And again, I think that she, just because she's contemporaneous to the era, she acts as that nice link. And she's good for the audience as well.
Yeah, she's one that the audience identifies with and say, like, yeah, this is what I do in this situation, isn't it?
Just thinking the byplay between Kirk and Spock in this movie, where at times they are almost like a comedy double act.
Yeah, they are.
And Spock is the deadpan.
Mm.
Another one of my favourite scenes is the bus to the Cetacean
Institute,
which has the immortal, a legendary Kirk Thatcher in it, and as the punk playing the song.
It's his own band's. A composition, isn't it?
Yes, it is indeed, and it's on the soundtrack. And I may treat listeners to a little burst of it.
I used it on Sound of Football, didn't I?
You did. That's right, after Brexit.
Yes.
Yeah. it's called "I Hate You," and it's a pastiche, noisy California style.
Who?
So do you remember the scene when they're?
Well, I know about it, but who did? Who was the guy?
The guy's name is Kirk Thatcher.
Oh, is it? Okay. I know.
Because he was an associate producer on it, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a runner.
Runner, basically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was more than more than a runner. Yeah. But, I mean, he was taken on as a runner.
Yeah,
and it turned out he was such a talented and hardworking guy that he ended up doing everything. And they gave him this scene where he's playing the punk. And so that's his band. Well, it's not. I mean, he's thrown it together, and it's a kind of. I don't think he's British. He's on Twitter, Kirk Thatcher. He's a man of many talents, and Spock obviously knows pensions, and that's fun.
And the big clap afterwards.
But then the discussion about the swearing.
Which is
the colourful metaphor.
The colourful metaphor.
Don't blame you.
It's the references to the literary references. The giants. Yeah, absolutely. Some. Genuine comedy in this, but also Scotty, James Doohan.
He's brilliant.
Is brilliant. Now, I'd like to just chat for a second about Jimmy Doohan, because I don't think that Jimmy Doohan is given his due. And I think this partially is possibly because we're British and because he's a Canadian playing a Scottish.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, you're not Scottish.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take anything away from his abilities as an actor.
No.
And he's really good in Voyager. I mean, he really sells the whole thing where he's this outraged overseas professor. But the way that the whole hello computer thing as well is absolutely brilliant. And I think that Jimmy Doohan deserved a lot more airtime. I think towards the end was getting a bit played for last. But I mean, we'll talk about it more when we come around to Wrath of Khan. But that moment when Spock enters the chamber, the only reason why we know what Spock is doing is absolutely suicidal is James Doohan's reacting. It's Scotty's reaction. Jimmy Doohan completely sells the audience to the audience that this guy is committing suicide. You know, and only a high quality actor I think could get away with doing that. And I think that these are lovely moments to have him there.
Yeah, I mean the whole film is brilliant with all the cast members actually have a piece to play in this. Mm. And it is
only Sulu of, is.
Yeah,
stitched.
Sulu. Yeah, he's stitched up to.
I was born there.
I was apart from.
He gets to fly a helicopter.
It does. Yeah, and
he does get to say San Francisco. Yeah, I was born there, which is one of the best lines in film ever.
Yeah,
you know,
he has some of the best lines in the movies. I mean, he's also the 30 seconds to space doors and he's great. So, but yeah, I mean, Nichelle Nichols gets something to do, and obviously Chekhov.
Yeah, yeah. He's pretty good with his nuclear vessels.
The nuclear vessels. Do you think he should have known where Alameda was, though? Because
it wouldn't have moved.
It wouldn't have moved. Would it? What happened to Alameda?
He
should know where it is, right? I mean, you might not know how to get there
yeah.
by public transport in 1986, but he should know where it actually is. Where is Alameda?
I think so, mate. But I think for the purposes of the story, I think it worked.
Yeah. We'll overlook it.
Yeah. And also, you must give a little bit of due to the cop who just stands there looking at them and doesn't do anything. Brilliant. He just walked out of a nightclub. From some sort of
he was probably in there with the guy dressed as a Nazi, the half naked Vulcan, and the hipster.
Sorry, that's a UKIP conference.
But I think that's the interplay between them and the normal people, the everyday people. It's like when Kirk sells his glasses.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I'll give you $500.
Is that a lot?
$100.
It was $100, isn't it? Yeah.
Inflation and everything.
They just completely make that film what it is. It's such an endearing film, and that's why I say it doesn't have the kind of visceral quality. I think those kind of highs and lows that you get.
Well, I think it's because it doesn't. You don't get transported back to the. It doesn't cut back to the problems that are happening in the 23rd century, does it?
No, that's right.
You only go because obviously there's no time difference between them going and then coming back, is
there? That's right, because there's that bit when they come back, transport the whales. We'll go back to this a bit more, but I mean, when they come back to transport the whales and then they finally arrive back in their time, and they go, oh, where are we? Have we made it? When are we?
Yeah.
And then you hear the chuck, 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 and you suddenly. As the audience, you suddenly remember why they did this in the first place. Yeah. Oh no, this film's not over.
Yeah.
And there's this chop, 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 and you go, oh, and that sound effect works really, really well, I think, in that. Because it's just suddenly everything goes dark, and then the noise comes, and you think, now we're back in really unpleasant time, and they've got to sort it out. And I mean, I think that's the good thing about that sound effect, not the stuff, the whining stuff that you didn't like. Really ominous and completely drops the viewer out of the reverie of having enjoyed that little adventure and thinking, actually.
That romp was fun, wasn't it? The Earth's being destroyed, isn't it?
We're all going to die. That's not so good. That's not so good. Let's talk a little bit about Spock's character.
Let's back right to the beginning.
Zombie Spock.
Because obviously, Zombie Spock, he's just got his mind back. He's a. That's the thing I always didn't understand, because he's been regrown.
Save it for Search for Spock.
All right,
Search for Spock, we'll talk
right at the beginning. I mean, this is a lovely little sequence when we're actually on Vulcan, which I love seeing bits of Vulcan. But I still have to take issues with those bloody gnome hats.
Those
Vulcans wearing, you know, the ground crew.
I bought you a gnome hat for Christmas.
You know,
great.
But they've got these
stupid
hats.
Well, you know, I think you'd be surprised how many hats.
I mean, they've got the ears.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, a bowler hat is the same shape as the top of our ears.
Yeah.
So really, their gnome hats are just the same shape as the top of their ears.
In fairness, when did you ever see, you know, engineers and mechanics wearing bowler hats?
Yeah.
Well, it depends. If it was like in the 19th century, everyone would have been wearing
because we were all wearing bowler hats.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, the colour they chose as well is blue and red. It does look like a gnome hat.
It's obviously got some very logical reason for its design.
Someone who designed it basically hated Vulcans and wanted to take the piss out of them. That's what it was about. You know, maybe they were Romulan.
Maybe they were. Maybe they were Romulan. Yeah, Romulan tailors.
Back to Romulan, really short sequence with Robin Curtis as
yes,
and as Savick.
Yeah,
who was cut out of the show, basically.
Yeah.
But they asked her if she would come in and just do this.
Yeah.
You know.
Just to sort of, you know, and she said yes, which is decent of her, I suppose, because she might have...
Yeah, I would love to have seen more of her, you know, because she's stunning. She's stunning as well. I mean, anyway.
She's not as good as Kirstie Alley, but I guess she's probably used to people saying that. But we'll have a Salic debate at some point in the future. Yeah. Look, I love the sequence at the beginning when Spock goes to those little computer terminals.
That is brilliant. That's one of the picks of the film for me.
You get
and especially the bit afterwards with
Amanda, and it's lovely to see Miss Jane Byatt in. Coming at Wyatt, I should say, making an appearance of that. It's really touching. And she, and that, because you in that sequence, you've got the whole right, okay, he's obviously, he's recovered, he knows what he's doing. And then the confrontation about how do you feel?
Mm.
How do you feel? How do you, I love that. I do love that. And from a long time, used it.
Mm.
And, you know, he doesn't understand the question, and then Amanda. That's gives him a lesson
because I often use the nothing unreal exists.
Nothing unreal exists.
I think it's great. Explains so much.
It does explain.
And always, and I always sit there at work going, computer,
computer. Sorry.
I mean that was it really. I mean, I just wanted to reflect on that scene in general.
Well, I mean, he's so good because he carries this thing throughout this confused Spock. Throughout the whole thing, and the fact that he's walking around in a bathrobe for the whole thing is just brilliant, especially when he's walking around in San Francisco, because it's one place where he could probably get away with it.
That would be Venice Beach in LA, couldn't he?
Yeah, so it is great. I mean, and he has, it's a very, very different spot, but obviously it's not, it's the same spot, but it is one that's actually probably more Spock than ever, really, isn't it?
Well, I was just going to say that sort of, it's very interesting, actually, when the scene opens at the beginning, when the first time you see Spock is when Kirk looks up and sees this figure up on this sort of cliff bit, sort of just standing there with the sun behind it, or the sort of, you know, the sort of in shadow. And it reminded me of Star Trek The Motion Picture, because when you had the bit on Vulcan... as well at the beginning of Star Trek The Motion Picture when you had the reintroduction to Spock as well, you know, because it does seem, he seems to be sort of within himself, lost as well in both of
and
those.
Kirk knows it too. Yeah. The way that Kirk looks up at Spock, and there's a look on his head of a kind of things aren't right, you know, things aren't quite, he isn't the same guy. It's not the same guy. And the film is also... One of the subtexts of the film is the journey, the restoration of Kirk and Spock's friendship. Mm-hmm. Because Kirk loses his temper with Spock at one point.
Mm-hmm.
When Spock appears to not completely grasp the fact that, you know, everybody is going to die. This seems to be quite spiteful
after a while.
And you get, and so even the comedic moments where Spock is sort of like trying to remember when he called his mate Jim and, you know, and the whole thing about the colourful metaphors and don't swear, you don't, haven't got the hang of. But there's also moments in which he gets quite angry in general with everyone and reminding us that, you know, they're here to do some work and not just to have fun, but also to express frustration with Spock and the fact that Spock is still not getting it. And of course it's fine. It resolves itself at the end of the film. Spock sort of like gets a clue and Kirk works it out. And the genesis of that is actually in that exchange that you just described. Kirk is down there, he's just been speaking to the crew, he looks up, there's Spock on the mountainside, aloof, and, you know, not entirely with everyone, and he reflects that very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I can't understate the ability of William Shatner as an actor. He's a fine actor. You know, I think he because he plays Wyatt, he's synonymous with a single character, that somehow denigrates his skills, but his facial expressions is with the way that he conveys emotions to an audience without having to say anything. I mean, he's a real art, and he would have been at the peak of his powers, really, at that stage in his career. And it's a fine performance, I think, by him, and indeed by Nimoy, who, again,
I think one of my favourite things about my DVD copy of Voyage Home is the fact that it includes a commentary by William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy.
Oh.
And it's one of the most enjoyable DVD commentaries I've ever listened to. I don't make a habit of listening to them, but when I got my copy of Star Trek IV, I thought I've got to listen to this.
Mm.
And it's just brilliant. It never lets up. The two of them just have their same. They have a sort of a banter going off there that you would really hope that they would have off camera. And then there are some wonderful moments in there, isn't there, Terry?
Yeah. Well, there's the bit where is it? It's in the restaurant.
It's in the restaurant.
Shatner is saying, "Oh yeah, this is a nice little place down.
I love this place. I take my family there."
Yeah, that's right. And then. But on Okuda's, Mike Okuda's text commentary, yeah. It says, "This is a set.
This is on the Paramount Rock."
which is, who would deny people those kind of memories?
Exactly.
But that's the thing with Shatner is he's actually a comedian as well, which he shows throughout this.
Oh, he thinks he's funny.
Yeah. He thinks he's funny. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I mean, all right, he's not a comedian. He's just, you know,
yeah.
He's a clown.
Yeah, I think
if you read his tweets, you'll know exactly what the sort of guy he is.
He's strong as an ox. I mean, he's 80 plus. He's still working, and he's working very hard. I mean, he's a old school pro. I mean, if the job is there, if the gig is there, he'll take the gig. Yeah. Yeah. And these are admirable quality that I find in professional actors.
Well, can we just go back to the bit where the whales have been released?
And yeah,
what happens they're immediately being chased.
That's brilliant. Yeah,
they're immediately being chased. Yeah,
they've not been out 5 minutes, and Norwegians are coming after them with their rusty harpoons.
Okay. And I was actually looking around trying to work out who they were. Were they Norwegians?
You know, they were obviously some hue of Scandinavia.
Exactly.
You know,
who love whales.
Romans. Yeah, that's what they were.
The message of the conservation, there's a strong message, isn't there? And it's a really on the nose message. It's the you're killing the environment, and this is you're killing off these great wonderful creatures. And I mean, what do we think about that as a message goes? I mean, I always appreciate stuff like that, but is it a little bit too? Could it have been a bit more nuanced? I wonder.
I don't think so. I think it's one of the things that environmental campaigners often say is that what we say now will be mainstream in 10, 15 years time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is exactly what's happening. You've got the Save the Whale campaign from the early 70s, taking 15 years to get to become mainstream in Star Trek IV, and everyone's accepting it as being something that is a message to be told there. And yes, it's not subtle at all, but I think.
Well, you can forgive it because it's 30 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, and you've got to get this sort of thing in there. And I think it stops the ending from being drawn out too much. I think it's quite well paced.
Yeah,
really.
Because you would think that ending where they've released the whales into San Francisco Bay and they talk to the creature, that could have been. I mean, if that would have been motion picture, probably would have lasted. Yeah.
But they didn't actually release it to San Francisco Bay. That's the bit I thought they did, but they said that they've actually moved them to Alaska.
We're talking cross purposes. You're right. No, the whales were shipped from San Francisco to Alaska and we're overnight.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense, but that's
I'd have thought you just opened the gates and let them out.
Yeah, but they didn't.
Obviously not.
No,
now you know different, don't
you? Now I do know. I mean, what do I know about whale moving? When did I ever move a whale?
Well, why were these bloody Norwegians outside San Francisco?
And what were they doing in US waters anyway?
Yeah.
They should have been, blown from the water by American stuff or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, no, that is a great scene, and with the bird of prey decloaking and just watching those whales, it's very satisfying to see, rotten wrongans, pooing their pants.
Yeah, and immediately turning and doing a complete 180.
And the sequence itself at the end when they release the whales for the second time, only this time in the 23rd century, and I think that works quite well when the George or Gracie... sort of inverts him or herself, and then the little round ball that you don't like, you know, that and mirroring with the eye. I thought that was quite nice.
I did think of that when I saw it. Because it's on its side and then it's an eye.
Yeah.
Because originally when it was coming down, that licorice was underneath.
Yeah.
So, but obviously in space, who's know what's up and down and so on. But
yes, no, that's there are no. It's fair enough. You don't. We've established that you don't like the probe.
No. But does anyone like the probe?
Well, I suppose it depends on whose probe it is, really.
Yeah.
And the film ends with a reconciliation and all is forgiven.
But also the film ends on, not the end, but the bit when they've actually released George and Gracie. It's just that lovely shot with the whole, you know, of the Star Trek family are actually holding on to the...
they're all having fun in the water,
aren't they? Yeah, and it's just, it's actually really
nice. Celebrating.
And everyone in the pool.
Away
you go.
Except... Did you notice when Scotty decides to do his big belly flop?
Yep. meanwhile,
and you can see they're actually standing up.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in Nevada. Is it raining?
But that was nice.
That was a nice, and that was a touching moment, and rounded things off nicely. The film obviously ends setting things up for another movie because they figure that they're going to do another movie.
And then there's a second ending, where
they decide to drop all the charges, basically, apart from one, demote, I should say, Admiral Kirk back to captain and put him back on board the Enterprise. And the Enterprise...
Brand new Enterprise.
Yeah. The backstory is for this, that this ship was going to be called something else. It was commissioned as something else.
Yeah.
And they decided to redesignate it as Enterprise and add the extra A. As a thank you,
and it's a lovely approach because they're speculating that it's going to be given the Excelsior, go over the Excelsior, and on the other side is a gleaming white ship.
Yes, and it's lovely, and it's very pleasing, it's very satisfying,
and the interior is
great, and then the sounds as well. Yes. In a brief moment, you get the sounds. Yeah. And they've taken sounds from the original Enterprise bridge, which they hadn't done before.
Oh. I know we went absolutely nuts.
It was the first thing we heard. Yeah. We went, the sounds are the same. Good God. Nerds, aren't we?
We were, We didn't have girlfriends.
We didn't have girlfriends, no. And then off they go, and we're all very much looking forward to it. And even the end titles are lovely because it's got a similar to the original series where they have little segments.
Well, I was watching the end titles, and it was synonymous with those 80s TVs when you have sort of like, you know, and, you know, guest starring, blah, 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 and all that sort of stuff. And obviously the lovely music that sort of introduced each bit as it fades up. Yeah, it was nice.
There was something else that I did want to talk about very briefly, but I'd forgotten about, and I'd like to just take you back there, because I would like to mention it, and that is the relationship in this film between McCoy and Spock.
Mm.
Because they have a couple of exchanges which are very enjoyable, and obviously there's been animosity between the two, there's been anger between the two, but obviously having shared his consciousness for a while, and you know, there's perhaps that deeper understanding. And I like the way where Spock is compelled to have to make a guess, and McCoy sort of like encourages him that you'll just have to, you know, guess. And Kirk, you know, he trusts your guesses more than other people's facts. And I thought that was nice. And I also liked when he tried to get his insights on death. And he says, "You truly have gone where no man has gone before." Do you? You mean I have to die to discuss your insights on death?
How can we have a conversation? There's no joint frame of reference.
These are really nice scenes and cap things off nice. I mean, that could have been the last ever Star Trek film, and I think it would have worked absolutely.
It would have. Yeah, I mean, I think that was the beer. If they'd sailed off into the sunset on that ship, they shouldn't.
I mean, a lot of people do love Star Trek 6, and are happy that film exists.
Yeah.
But after, the film afterwards, I don't think we'll ever bother doing a podcast about Star Trek 5.
No, I just don't think there's any need to.
Yeah, I mean, people have their own view on that. I don't think we've got anything to add.
Are there any favourite scenes? Because you forget that the whole of this film is made up of lots of little, you know,
sketches almost.
Sketches, perfect.
Yeah, little little set up pieces, aren't they?
Too many to remember, to be perfectly honest with you.
You know, because I was just thinking about the scene in the hospital, because it was just such a farce.
Yeah. Oh, this is all part of the romp thing, isn't it? And this is really perhaps the focus of it, because it's a direction the story doesn't need to go in.
No,
it's just more of let's have more fun.
We need a little bit more peril. Let's have a little bit more peril. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, because they might have thought it was a bit soft.
Because as well, it's lovely that whole part, because it starts off with the interrogation.
Which is
just funny anyway, isn't it?
You
play games with me and we're through.
We are? Can I go now? Yeah. I'll take it from the top. Yeah. The top of what? And Walter Koenig does that really, really well. And McCoy is awesome in the hospital.
Yes,
obviously he cures the lady with the kidney disease and he's just throwing the equipment around.
With the conversation with the surgeon there. Thunderscopic.
But it goes back to what you said. Yeah. Almost everybody had something meaningful to contribute to this movie, with the possible exception of Takei. And without it seeming forced or necessarily laboured.
Yeah.
The most laboured part of the film is the hospital and Chekhov's capture. But really, that isn't that laboured.
No. Yeah,
that
works quite nicely. It's not, is it? Because we've spoken before about how difficult it is to make an ensemble piece and make it work. Give everyone a little cameo. And I think this is the problem that later films, like the Next Generation film, suffered from, was their need to give everyone a bit in it.
Yeah.
And when, you know, if this was a double episode, you wouldn't have bothered doing that. You would have said, well, let's get the story.
Yeah.
Let's tell the story.
Yeah.
What needs to be told.
Absolutely.
And then if we've got time, like what this one is, if we've got time and it fits well within the story, let's do it. And I think the hospital is the greatest thing.
Yeah. I mean, you've got two movies in one, haven't you?
Yeah.
You've got the bookend of the frame story, which is the peril and the reconciliation and resolving the fact that they're supposed to be going to prison and all of that. And then you've got this movie within the movie, which is everybody has to work together for a common goal. So everybody gets a chance to make a contribution.
Mm.
And it sets it up really well in a way that normal Star Trek episodes can't do.
Yeah.
And I think that's why a lot of people don't see it as being a regular Star Trek film. They see it as having an entirely different beat. But there are plenty of time travel episodes in Star Trek up to that point. Obviously, there will be more as well, and good ones too, where they do go back to contemporary America to have a look around.
And as we said before in the previous episodes with stuff like Patterns of Force and Piece of the Action, they sometimes have a more comedic element because they're in an Earth environment or in a familiar environment of what we know.
And the film allows us the opportunity to have a projection of what we would like the idea of, certainly the Star Trek idea and Nimoy's idea about humanity in the future, and how different it is to how we are now.
Yeah.
And how, in some respects, how far we've got to go.
Yeah.
But in other respects, how little we have to travel as well. And that's, I think that's a very, very Star Trek thing that happens. Does anybody else have anything they would like to say about this film?
No, it's just that it's a very good romp. I think you can watch it without being big fans of Star Trek, because it is, you know.
I think that's the biggest thing about this one, and obviously why it's so popular. This opens the doors for people.
Yes,
to Star Trek, and if it's the only Star Trek film you ever see, then this is.
Yes,
the good way to do it, because it you don't have to be, even though there's lots of Star Trek stuff in here.
Mm.
And the whole scene when Spock is decoding the messages the probe is sending out, and you know, looking at it from well, let's reconfigure the sound to see what it's like underwater, and then all of a sudden when he realizes, you know, we cannot send the answer to the response to this, and that's such a classic Trek, isn't it? Really, so it's beautiful, and it's very similar to what we were talking about in the previous episode of Devil in the Dark, wasn't it? About the fact of he's already cottoned on to something there.
Yeah,
you've got to come along.
We're dealing with something here that is completely alien, and we have to think of it differently.
Yeah. And so the fact is that you naturally assume that the message is meant to be for us.
Yes. So. Or human arrogance.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Love it. Love it. Love it.
Love it. Yes. Love it. Okay, well, we're going to finish, I think, with that. So thanks, guys. Thanks very much for your contributions, and thanks very much for this. And thank you to the listeners for listening to us again. Whompoddestroy.com is where we're at. We have a Twitter as well. It's Whompoddestroy. And there is an Instagram page, but we don't really use that. But I don't know, maybe in the future we might do. Graham's thinking about tinkering with some graphics. And Derek's threatening to revamp the website at some point. So do have a look there and hook us up. garth@whompoddestroy.com is the email address. So if you want to reach out on a more personal basis, then by all means do. And we would, of course, be most grateful if you took the time to share this podcast and your experience of this podcast with your friends and enemies with whom you seek reconciliation on your social networks, because that helps us boost our listeners and makes us feel better about ourselves.
It does indeed.
Okay, and so without further ado, we'll say goodbye.
One, two, three, four! Goodbye.